Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. So for those of you who have latrophobia, or as more commonly known, a fear of doctors, bad news. Researchers have crunched the numbers, and an apple a day does not keep the doctor away. Joining us on the line to go over this and other pressing medical headlines is Art Kaplan. Art, as you know, is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Hello there, Art.
Hey, how are you?
Great.
Good morning, Art Kaplan. So before we get to the devastating news of the day, there's a lot of it today from my colleague here, Jim Browdy. Let's start with the story that is still all over the newspapers, a terrible crash into the French Alps on March 29th at the German jetliner. You've written about this. You know, a lot of talk about the co-pilot who drove the plane or rode the plane or steered the plane, whatever it is, into the Alps, battles on and off with depression. So what should be done about screening pilots, and how do you deal with pilots that have depression issues?
Well, I think you've got to up the ante a little bit on the annual physical. Pilots do get tested every year. They get a physical. Actually, if they get older, I think it's over 55, they get it every 6 months. And so they're looking for heart conditions and vision problems and things that might interfere. But the person who does the exam really doesn't do more than a few gentle questions about mental health or addiction, and I think that needs to be beefed up. Probably need some training for the people doing the exams so that they could ask better questions, if you will, or maybe even have a psychologist be part of that exam. It's not cheap, but it's probably worth it in terms of trying to screen. The other thing is everybody has to understand, if you really fear that someone is going to hurt or harm someone, is suicidal, murderous, there is and has been for decades a recognized duty to tell others, to tell the authorities, to tell the employer, to tell appropriate third parties. There's no doubt about that. It's called the Tarasoff standard. It's been in place forever from a legal case back in California in the 70s. So no doubt, if you know that, if you believe that someone's going to hurt somebody, you've got to say something.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up, because one of the things we've discovered is that this pilot had multiple notes from doctors, including one that was found in his apartment torn up and saying that he was not fit to work and was not fit to work on this particular day. So did these doctors fail in their obligation to report this? Or
yeah, if they didn't really call the airline and say, you know, Lubitz, the one of your flight crew, is really not fit to fly, that is not honoring their ethical duty, what they're supposed to do if they really think that he isn't fit to fly. So they do have to say something. They have to speak up. That would be true in the U.S. Obviously, Germany isn't bound by American ethics or American court opinions, but that standard of duty to warn has been adopted almost all around the world.
You know, Art, the bigger issue for me, at least here, and obviously not to minimize the horrible death of 149 people in addition to this co-pilot, is every time one of these things happens, and I'm sure you're closer to it than we are, is everybody with depression in this instance gets stigmatized, meaning we can't have them do this, we can't have them do that. What can people who have depression but who have brought it under control and having it treated, either through therapy or drugs or whatever, what can they do and what can't they do?
Well, I think they can, unfortunately, do very little if they're severely depressed. They're not really a threat to anybody, because that's the classic stay in bed, can't move, draw the blinds down. You know, the severest forms of depression, they're probably less risky to anybody else than anybody on this show right now.
How about walk around kind of depression? Treated and you're in the world.
Yeah, so I think what the difference is depression where you get suicidality, where you somehow or another talk and harm, and just people who kind of feel low and then up, manic depression, that sort of thing. And just not ducking your question, the answer is I think they can do a lot. I think the key is whether it's a surgeon or a pilot or anybody else, you kind of need to get them into treatment, see how that goes, and then you require that if they're going back to work, they have to be supervised for a while. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't let that guy be alone in the cockpit, so to speak. So you want to watch them, see how they're doing. That's what we do when we have a physician who's been through a drug rehab program. They can't operate by themselves. They can't treat people by themselves. They have to be with somebody all the time.
But the bottom line is the diagnosis in and of itself should not be a life sentence where you can't do X or Y. depending on the circumstances of the individual, right?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, you know, look, if you get schizophrenic, you're probably not going to be flying planes.
Yeah.
But for most of the mental health issues, I think they can be managed pretty safely. I don't think the stigma that, you know, goes with this is enough to say, no, once you've identified with any mental health problem, you're out of the air. By the way, we keep talking about the pilots, but, you know, you'd want to take a look at the mechanics. It's probably the case. You want to take a look at the flight attendants. And I don't even know in the U.S. what the air traffic controllers do. But
That's a great question.
You know, I do know that we do try to do addiction testing on subway conductors, train guys, truckers have to go through it. Interesting enough, there's a group that doesn't, doctors. And I've been yelling about that for a long time.
You wrote a great piece about it, yeah.
Yeah, they ought to get screened more. And I think some occasional, maybe every 3 years, mental health probing might be a good idea for folks who hold lives in their hands.
Why don't they?
Doctors have been fighting it because they basically see it as too intrusive. They don't need it, and the profession can take care of its own. I just don't buy it. I don't think any group can take care of its own and does a good job. Here's the words we use: snitching, ratting.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's hard.
Okay, Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist. Let's move on to some devastating news from Mr. Brussels Sprouts over here. That's Jim. Jim Browdy is here with his little Tupperware containers every day. He's a big apple a day eater, and he's big into these fish oil pills as well. Now we find out that yet again, something that was sort of that you heard forever, an apple a day keeps the doctor away, and more recently, that fish oil claims can help you with heart disease. Are these up in smoke?
Well, the only person who used to talk about apple a day, I think, were grandmothers, so I'm not sure they were the greatest.
Excuse me, they were my grandmothers, but thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah, but I always
think fish oil a little more. There were some studies that popped up, actually, of people in Greenland and the Arctic who seemed to have low heart disease rates, and it was imputed to their eating fish and whales and seals even and things like that. But that data never held up. You know, it just wasn't reconfirmed by subsequent studies. So now we got big studies starting to show up, and they're not showing any real benefit from fish oil. In fact, there's a little risk if you do the baby aspirin thing and the fish oil.
Yep.
It might cause you a little bit too much propensity to bleed. So we're back to the world of supplements, and Jim keeps begging me one week to say, yep, vitamins, good. And I refuse, except for vitamin D, where there are deficiencies sometimes. But generally, supplements don't do much, and fish oil doesn't seem to be doing much. I think there's more to worry about in terms of ingredients and are they what they say they are. We have a big case in New York State. The attorney general of the state is going after GNC stores saying, you're selling all kinds of stuff, and we tested the stuff. None of the contents of these leafy brews are what they say they are. And I think that's a huge problem in supplements.
You know, one of the things...
Otherwise, I like supplements.
Well, this big fish oil debunker was about mostly heart disease and fish oil. But the thing is...
And to be fair, it was that it didn't prevent people who were at high risk. It wasn't a big study of people, just general folks.
But you know what you see on TV all the time, especially if you watch CNN, where the ads, you know, people ask why people don't watch CNN. I think it's because of the ads, because they're so depressing. They're all about catheters and you're going to be dead tomorrow and stuff like that. But one of the things I constantly see...
Excuse me, they have discount catheters. It's actually
discount
quite a draw.
Catheters,
go ahead.
That's right. You know,
by the way, isn't that the place where you can buy a discount catheter and then put all your money into gold and head into a large silo somewhere?
Yeah. You know, the news is great, but the commercials are so depressing. But anyway, one of the things they talk about with fish oil, too, on these ads is for your eyes as you age, which I guess, I don't know if this has to do with glaucoma or whatever it has to do
Excuse
with.
Excuse me, look who's not wearing glasses in this studio, Marjorie.
Okay, so you think that...
I don't know.
But is that out the window, too?
I can't say it's out the window because I don't even think that one was ever in the window.
Oh, okay.
I don't know where that...
Hey, before we leave the topic, in addition to apples and fish oil pills, I'm big into kumquats. And this is a serious question. I think I read somewhere the other day.
Art Kaplan should be here
in
studio.
Can I talk to Art for a second?
I just want to tell you, Art, if you were here, you would see Jim with several Tupperware containers, and he's got the Brussels sprouts, as I mentioned before, and one. He's got this huge thing of kumquats. You must have like 50 kumquats.
By the way, if I ever heard a description of why I will never be in that studio,
it's unbelievable.
But wait a second. I thought I read the other day when Marjorie was spitting out the kumquat I gave her that there's some part of the world where people are living longer or close to as long as anybody on the planet, and one of the staples of their diet are kumquats. Am I off base there, too?
I have no idea. Okay. I don't know what in the heck you are talking about.
Okay, fine.
You mean the Bhutanese kumquat triumph?
Maybe Art could weigh in on the chia seeds and the flax seeds.
I prefer
and all
not.
That kind
Thank
of,
you.
Kind of stuff. I mean, we have a lot of that in studio as
Look,
well, Art.
I will say this. If those are the snacks, they're a lot better than, you know, snacking on peanut butter cookies and fatty things and
Thank
candy.
You.
So, you know, if that's better. I mean, look, we've said it time and again, a good balanced diet with the appropriate amount of exercise is probably your best risk avoidance. But if you like to snack on healthier things, I'm not against it. I'm just saying you don't really need a magic bullet to fight off a particular disease. A balanced diet will get you where you want to go.
I got to pop in a kumquat. Can you wait 1 second? I'll be right back.
Okay, you know, I don't even know what a kumquat is, I have to tell you.
Oh, God, they're awful.
You got to buy them. They're these little tiny things. They look like little tiny oranges. You eat them with the skin.
Yeah.
When you do the first bite,
it's like
they're incredibly
lemon.
Tart, lemon-like, and then they get sweet, and they're fabulous. And by the way, I don't know if you're aware, you live longer if you eat kumquats.
Yeah, okay.
This is a study.
Right, so there's your screening test for mental stability right there.
Hey, Art. We, like everybody in America, have spent a lot of time talking about this Religious Restoration Act out of Indiana, where the Governor Pence is doing an incredible 180 because he's worried that the NCAAs are coming to town this weekend. He wants a new law saying something, clarifying whatever that means. I'm not that into that for the moment, unless you are. What I'm really into is another thing that they're doing in Indiana that I am in full support of. We've had the discussion about this in the past. They have this right to try thing, which is a right to try drugs, bypassing a lot of the FDA approvals and permissions and things for people who are seriously ill. And I think I asked you this a few months ago. What possible argument, if you're really seriously ill and you want to try an experimental drug and you're compass mentis enough to know what you're doing, why shouldn't a law like this allow you to try something?
Yeah, actually, Indiana passed that law. There are now 12 states. Mississippi just passed it
yesterday. Really? Oh,
yep,
really?
There are 12 that have it, and I think it's pending in 20. So the issue about whether you want to try a drug if you're terminally ill or becoming severely disabled from Parkinsonism or going blind, that's another area where you get a lot of requests. People say, I can't wait for studies to be done. I've got to move now. I understand that, and I'm not saying it is wrong. You need to understand a couple of things. First, there are kooks and quacks out there who will sell you kumquats, charge you a lot of money, and say this will stop your cancer. So you got to be very careful that you vet, you know, what it is that you're being tried. I hate to say it, but there are doctors and ripoff artists who will prey on you and try to empty your wallet as you die. Second, there are side effects, and you might say, hey, I'm dying. What's the side effect? Side effect is it could kill you faster. Side effect is it could make you die more miserably. So you need to understand there's some risk even when you're when you get a terminal disease. But the biggest problem with these laws, and the reason they're ridiculous, is they don't obligate anybody to give you anything. They just say, we, the state legislature of Indiana, recognize your right to try. Okay. But the drug company isn't obligated to give you any medicine. The doctor doesn't have to do anything. It's just this empty rhetoric of, I support the right to try. So unless you're going to either create an obligation on drug companies to give some of their supply to dying people, or you're going to set up a fund to help them pay for it, it doesn't get one person drug. I think the first state that passed this law was Colorado last May. I don't know anybody in Colorado has gotten a drug because of that law.
Well, Art, if I mean this sincerely, because if you could draft the law that dealt with the quacks, that dealt with the obligation on the part of the drug companies to actually allow you to try, should you want to try, assuming you're fully apprised of the potential consequences, could you draft such a thing?
Yep, I can do it right now. 48-hour review has to be done by the FDA, and they have to do it in 48 hours, yes, no. Just going to happen that fast. And saying it's not quackery, it's somewhat not insane to do it. I think you'd then say we created a fund in the state of Massachusetts or the state of Indiana that will help you pay for this drug. If it's a little drug company, they're not going to give you the tiny amount they have. So we're going to create something that you could go to get some help. And if you need to travel to where the drug is, we're going to create that. So I'd move from a right to beg law, which is what Indiana and those other states have, to something that might be a little bit more of an entitlement for dying people. Then we can have a political fight, you, me, Marjorie, and say, well, how much do you want to put in that pot of money? Because it's nice to spend money on desperate things, but of course we want to spend money on things that are proven to work, and we don't do a great job giving access to those either.
Well, you're our medical ethicist. I guess I wonder if we should even be going this route, because it's obviously terrible it is if someone is desperately, you know, weeks away from death. On the other hand, we already know that we sink a massive percentage of our health care costs into prolonging life for an extra, like, month and a half.
Yeah.
So is this even a route we should be going down? I know that Mr., you know, Kumquat over here thinks that, you know, if the Kumquats don't work and the Brussels sprouts, the next thing is the miracle elixir. But, I mean, is it the right place to be going?
A limited amount of money, I think, can go to the desperately ill. I think Americans do want to give people a chance to be rescued when they're dying, even with new things. But you can't spend the bulk of your budget or anything like it on that kind of experiment. You know, we have kids that don't get dental care, don't get vaccinated.
Right.
Got plenty of people out there who don't get palliative care when they're dying, and I could go on. But, you know, even this new drug that's out there that cures hepatitis C, Sovaldi, Medicaid saying, I can't pay. VA is saying, I don't know. The thing works. It's proven. Stops hepatitis. Cures it. We don't have enough money right now to pay for it. So I'm going to say 98% of our budget should be going to things that are proven. A little bit of money, if you're lucky, you'll get some help getting something experimental.
One last question on this, Art. Why have 12 states moved so quickly? If Colorado was the first, and it was only a year ago, 12 states doing something dramatic like this, even if you think it's ineffectual, in 12 months is stunning, actually. What's that about?
Well, I do think, as you start off saying, Jim, that the people do want something done for the dying, and they don't understand why dying people shouldn't have the right to try things, although, let me repeat, they do. I mean, people write to drug companies all the time saying, please give me something. It's not like that didn't happen. But if you're a politician and you like being one and you want to keep being one, I don't think you're going to vote against the right to try.
We're talking with Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist from NYU. Art, I sound like I'm picking on Jim, but I'm only teasing him because I do love him, and I'm just teasing him a little bit. You know, there's this great – he's kind of won the MRI Hall of Fame Award for the number of MRIs.
I've had a few MRIs.
Yeah, he's had a few. He's when he calls in, it's going
to
be late.
They're looking to see if the kumquats have cleared his body or what.
Yeah, exactly. But this story talks about how many of us have a back pain, especially as we get older. But MRIs are not the solution for them. In fact, it may wind up costing you a fortune if you go the MRI route. So what is the deal with back pain and MRIs?
Well, MRIs are clearly overused. So is surgery for back pain, generally. I mean, not everybody. But we have a lot of intervention with not really great outcomes for a lot of people. So back pain, I think, I'm sound like Mr. Rogers of healthcare today, but if you lose weight, you'd have less back pain. You can see that it's occupational. Sometimes people's backs are put at risk because they're lifting too much or inappropriately, or they don't wear those support things, or a machine ought to do it, not a person. So that's a problem. And then people weight definitely causes back problems. So you get an obese nation, you're going to have more back pain.
Yeah, but Art, is the point they're trying to make here, and I may have missed it because I didn't want to read it because I knew Marjorie would mock me, is that MRIs, which, for those who don't know what MRIs are, they are, as we would say here, wicked precise x-rays, essentially, more precise than your traditional x-ray. Is the concern that they pick up incredibly minor things, which then causes a patient and maybe his or her doctor to say, well, maybe you should deal with that, when in fact you probably shouldn't deal with that and you wouldn't have dealt with it had you not had this precise x-ray kind of thing? Is that one of the points?
There's a lot of false positives from MRIs, and everybody's physiology, when you look at different people, looks different. So a lot of weird oddities are there that you wouldn't worry about except for the fact that you look and it looks weird. So then, and we don't have a big baseline that says, here's the whole range of normal, because we didn't do MRIs on everybody. So the weird tends to get equated with diseased and off we go. One other tiny problem, too many MRIs is too much radiation. So that carries its own little risk if you're getting exposed a lot again and again and again. So it's not that they're bad. They're okay, but you want to use them prudently.
So does that mean you can be radioactive after too many MRIs? I should be concerned.
Well, I don't know radioactive, but you could be beating up your cells. Okay. I think the cancer risk can go up if you're sitting there getting blasted all the time.
But a serious note about back pain. I always heard, again, and maybe I'm crazy, that if your back hurts, you're supposed to do sit-ups or core strength, as we call it now. That's one of the big things.
Pope, didn't you read the story about the Pope? The Pope's doctor literally says he's got back pain because he's traveling too much and he's eating too much. He weighs too much, and he says walk around the Vatican gardens or whatever it is, some sort of modest exercise. But one last thing on this, Art, is, and I have a hard time buying this, assuming the doctor does his or her job, is this not analogous to the whole recommendation, don't have those prostate cancer checks because they pick up too many minor things? You then have surgery, which is riskier. Well, so if the notion is you may learn too much from an MRI, you may learn too much from a prostate exam and then overreact, isn't the answer not to not have the exams, but to have doctors who give you sound advice who you trust? Isn't that a better solution?
Yeah, I think that's true. For example, not everybody's equal. If you have prostate cancer running in your family, you probably want to get tested and monitored. But for most of us, we're going to die before the prostate cancer kills us if we're men. So, yeah, everybody's prostate develops a little cancer, and it will probably kill you at 111. But, you know, we're probably not going to make it that far. So going through a lot of rigmarole with your prostate may not make sense. So it depends. Are you in a risk group? Do you have factors either from your history or your lifestyle? And that may drive whether or not you want to get monitored.
You know, just one last thing on these same ads that you see a lot on CNN, these life screening things, they're not really MRIs. People go in and they get, I guess it's a full body.
Excuse me, that was
X-ray?
A sponsor of ours at our former radio station, and I had one done.
Okay.
They do. I mean, it is one of these. Is that? Do you know what she's talking about?
I do. That's sort of, let me scan around
everything,
the body and see what we got.
I mean,
I'm not sure I'm buying that either. When people do physicals, you know, doctors, you march in their office, they may, you know, sort of measure your heart and they listen to you and do stuff. But I don't think they're doing the full body scans yet because, again, you kind of don't know what you're looking at most of the time. And I have to say, for some of those companies, I'm not sure who's reading the results anyway.
You know what I've been doing, and I'm surely not a medical ethicist, I admit. Instead, I stopped taking 2 baby aspirin in the morning, 2 kumquats. First thing, I've never felt better. Just do with it what you want, Art, okay?
All right, what's the Everyday Podcast about?
We're going to go back to our friend, the psychiatrist who's faced with a dilemma of tell, not tell. And probably going to make one other point we didn't make here, but let me end on it. You have to be tricky about mandating disclosure of mental illness because I'll tell you what people do. They go under assumed names. They go off the books. If you start saying everything's going to have to be turned over, you're probably going to drive people away from mental health. So
I'm so glad you said that because I think that's absolutely true. If you knew you were going to be turned in, you wouldn't go in a lot of
professions. You've got to use carrots, not sticks on this one. Otherwise, people will duck the system.
Okay, Art Kaplan, thank you very much.
Thanks,
so much information. I'm glad that...
And I'll go buy some kumquats right now.
And don't forget the chia seeds, the flaxseed, and the Brussels sprouts.
And the apple and the fish oil.
And the apple and the fish oil, that's right. Art Kaplan is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics Podcast. And happily for us, he joins us every Wednesday. Coming up, it's our annual April Fool's Day discussion. What have been your greatest hits and misses? That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.